is 5. I'll get more information.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order today is May 16th, 2013. The first bill we're going to hear is Senate Bill 426. I have someplace Senator Posansky right in front of me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 426 updates and conforms terminology to use term person with mental illness rather than mentally ill person.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you very much for allowing me to be here. Floyd Przonski, State Senator, District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. Senate Bill 426 has been amended to basically just deal with terminology within the mental health world, and basically it will use the terminology going forward, person with mental illness rather than mentally ill person. The reason the bill is before you, we actually were looking at this as one of the companion bill to another bill, Senate Bill 421, which was established to determine a way to deal with individuals who are suffering extreme mental illness or have mental illness and that they are not able to aid and assist. Through that process, we determined that 421 would be the vehicle for all that. Everything else was not needed for 426, and so it was brought to us our attention that we needed to conform to the current terms that are used, and so that's why you have the bill. So even though the bill is 71 pages in length, from my understanding, it's because I've gone through the statutes to wherever it had the term mentally ill person to now reflect that it would be person with mental illness. And that's it, Mr. Chair. Okay,
thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Przonski?
I'm assuming that the background statement that applies to the earlier bill, was this a separate, Senator?
It was.
Okay.
Yeah, this was a companion bill with the 421. 421, because of its potential cost, had to go to Ways and Means. And so when we freed up 426, this was a vehicle that could be used to make these changes.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing, open work session on Senate Bill 426A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 426A to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Representative Garrett moves Senate Bill 426A to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered, and please show the members excused that are not here. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to carry this.
Okay, Representative Tomei will be the carrier. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 492.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 492A requires disclosure to defendant of material information in possession or control of the district attorney that tends to exculpate the defendant, negate or mitigate defendant's guilt or punishment, or impeach a witness. Clarifies does not expand obligation or right to disclose personnel or internal affairs of law enforcement if officers. Prohibits conditioning a plea bargain on waiver of right. There are two amendments in front of the committee today. There's the A7. Which would make clear that information known to the district attorney is the information that's in play in this bill. And then there's the A8 amendment, which would add lines about making what evidence is defined as Brady would be that what the state intends to call as a witness at trial as far as impeachment goes.
Okay, thank you. Josh Marquis, Eric Nisley, Lex, I can't tell, and Jeff House, please. You can come up too, Doug, if you grab a chair.
Mr. Marker, we're all in opposition. You want to do the opposition first? Is that the way you want
to do proponents? Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
This is all proponents.
Okay, I grabbed the wrong list first here. Gail Meyer, Bronson James, Kaiser Rutledge, and Tom Cermak. You want to all come up together, or you can?
Yeah, she wants me.
Okay.
Ready to go? Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Tuesday was the 50th anniversary date of the decision of Brady versus Maryland, so the timing of this hearing is good in our hearts. We are We have a panel of two panels here of witnesses for you. I just briefly want to walk through the bill just briefly and then let you know that we do support the Dash A8 amendment. What the Dash A8 amendment does is it clarifies the phrase impeach a witness, and it clarifies it by way of impeach a witness that the state intends to call at trial. I believe it accurate to say that there's no contention as to the A8 amendment. The district attorneys are proposing the A7 amendment. It would limit, constrain the Brady duty to information only known to the district attorney, even if otherwise in the possession of the state. We do oppose that. That is below the standard set by Brady versus Maryland, and you'll hear testimony to that effect. There's two panels. Oh, first, and then let me also explain to you the chart. We have a new and improved chart from the Senate version. I might frame this later, I'm not sure. It looks at all 50 states. There are 29 states that codify Brady. The issue and dispute really for the committee right now is whether or not to accept the A7 amendment proposed by the district attorneys or not, which would focus on the standard or the scope of the district attorney's knowledge that this exculpatory evidence is present. This chart reviews the standard and scope as used in the other 29 states that codify Brady. And we'll get into that more in the testimony as well. The first panel here is a panel of three attorneys. They practice. They're in the trenches. They've got their Brady stories. They'll tell very short Brady stories so that you get an understanding of how this looks like in the field. And then the second panel is going to be comprised of David Angeli and Dave Frohnmeyer. David Angeli is an attorney in Portland. He's with principal of Angeli Law Group. They do state and federal criminal defense, focusing primarily on white-collar criminal defense. Yeah. Prior to that, Mr. Angeli was at Williams Connolly in Washington, D.C. He's an adjunct professor at Lewis and Clark, also teaching a case in federal white-collar crime. Mr. Frohnmeyer wants to make it very clear he's here in his personal capacity, so I will not otherwise go into details as to Mr. Frohnmeyer's past legal history. So, the panel.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Bronson James. I'm an attorney in Oregon. It's my pleasure to be in front of the committee once again. So I'd like to share just with the committee just one example, and I want to emphasize that this is one amongst many that I might theoretically be able to share with this committee of issues that I've had with Brady discovery in Oregon. In this particular case, this was a multi-county prosecution, and during the first case in one county, we had made multiple requests for the emails between the investigating detective and the alleged victim. We believed that they existed. We made, I believe, five separate requests. They were not turned over. We ended up actually issuing a subpoena duces tecum to that detective to come to trial with the emails. The state moved to quash that subpoena duces tecum, refusing to turn over the emails. That court granted it. The emails were not turned over. The case resulted in that county in a conviction. We then proceeded to the second county, new county prosecutor. The day before trial turns over to us an email, says, this just came to me. It was an email between the investigating detective and the victim, lengthy, discussing all manner of things, including the fact that there was a potential unknown suspect that the victim believed might have been involved. None of this had been turned over to us. We moved for a violation in that county. The court in that county ordered, finally, the production of the emails. We were then eventually produced 61 pages of emails between the investigating detective, the victim, and even other potential suspects, none of which had been produced to the defendant up until that time, but were known by the state. And then the second story I might add to the committee just very briefly, I had a case one time involving a shooting. It was a shooting in a public place, and there were multiple potential witnesses. We had police reports that one of those witnesses had identified our client via a photo throwdown. What we didn't know, and we didn't know until our own investigation discovered it months later, is that same photo throwdown had been shown to several other witnesses who, when we interviewed them, said, oh, I made it clear to the investigating detective that none of those people were the shooter. That information, the investigating detective had chosen not to put down in any sort of written report, so that nothing was provided to the defense on that as well. And I want to emphasize to the committee, particularly with respect to the first instance that I related, when those Brady-type issues were resolved in court, the very first thing that the circuit court judge did was reach for the statute book. Not for case law, not for a printout of Brady or its progeny. They reached for the statute book. And that's why a statutory codification of Brady makes practical sense in how trials are litigated in Oregon. And again, I want to emphasize, these are just two stories that I could give you of many that I might have.
Thank you. Oh, any question?
Bronson, can you just go over the Brady rule?
Sure.
Frame it for us.
So, Brady, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, 50 years old, basically sets forth a duty by the prosecutor to turn over exculpatory information to the defendant. And that's important because in criminal cases, particularly in Oregon, criminal discovery does not work like civil discovery. In a civil case, when I represent a party, I can depose the other side. I can demand document production from them. I can send them interrogatories. None of those options work in criminal cases. Criminal cases rely on the prosecution turning over material. Since Brady, the Supreme Court has clarified aspects of that to include the fact that exculpatory information is included as well as impeachment of witnesses, that type of information. The other thing that's very important, in Kyles v. Whitley, the U.S. Supreme Court made it clear that it is the duty of the prosecutor to know what is in the files of law enforcement. So this artificial wall is not permissible. And the Supreme Court was very clear that the prosecution has a duty to know what's in law enforcement's files, and therefore you can't defeat the Brady obligation to turn it over by simply saying, well, it was in the investigating detective's file, but it never made it into mine. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, perfect. Can I ask
you, Mr. Chair? So help me understand, Mr. James, if Brady versus Maryland 50 years ago, if they said this was what should happen, why is it that in Oregon something different is happening, as you claim?
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, first of all, I want to make clear that my stories are one amongst many that you might hear, and the defense bar is replete with them. I think things you need to understand, and I've said this to the committee before, and I'll say it again. Criminal law is to law kind of what MASH is to medicine sometimes. Things happen in a hurried up fashion. They happen with a very crowded court docket. Prosecutors have very crowded dockets. Defense attorneys, particularly public defenders, have very crowded dockets. The important thing to recognize here is I don't think anybody is attributing malice or some sort of malicious intent here. But Brady simply makes clear that the prosecution has an obligation. The state, when the state chooses to criminally charge someone and to bring the weight of government against somebody, they have an obligation to turn that material over. Why, because it has existed in constitutional case law, has it necessarily not made its way into real-world practice? First of all, I would say that it has made its way into real-world practice, but there have been gaps. But because I'm sure public pressure, caseload pressure is what I meant to say, makes falling through the cracks possible, I also think that the reality of litigating criminal cases in circuit court is that often the first stop of all the parties involved are the applicable statute books. And if things can get resolved in statute, that tends to be where they get resolved, rather than going into the constitutional dynamic and arguing case law.
Thank you.
not to say that doesn't happen, it obviously does, but statutes are often the first opportunity that people take to analyze the legal issue.
Mr. James, just to be clear, though, it's not your contention, to kind of follow up with Representative Tomei's question, that by putting this into statute, that'll somehow eliminate Brady issues and prosecutions?
Chair Barker, counsel, my contention is that it will help. I believe by having it in statute, that will help.
So, Mr. James, your contention that law enforcement's not aware of Brady right now?
Chair Barker, counsel, I can tell you that in a recent Brady case that I litigated, the detective, when questioned about whether he turned over Brady material, told the court, I'm not sure what Brady is, but I have my statute book.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tom Cermak. I'm the public defender in Marion County. I'm here to relate briefly the facts of a case that was recently in my office. I was not the trial attorney for the defense. That lawyer is unfortunately unavailable today. This case involved a charge of sexual abuse that was made by a child in Idana, Oregon, which is a suburb of Detroit. The allegation was that I was asleep. I woke up. She was at the house of her little friend and staying overnight. She said, the little friend's father, I woke up, the little friend's father was touching me. I know who he is. He touched me on my clothes, and I know he always drinks vodka from a Pepsi cup. Well, that information was revealed to us in the course of the police report, and both our client and other witnesses said, he doesn't do that. He never drinks vodka. He's a beer drinker exclusively, but so-and-so, who was also staying at the house, who was roughly the same age as this rather elderly guy, does drink vodka from a cup. Well, we made a report. We found a witness who would say, yes, that's what we see, and we made that report and disclosed it to the district attorney. We didn't hear anything back for quite a while. We named the individual that was supposedly drinking from a Pepsi cup. Didn't hear anything back. We then located by accident this witness. Happened to be up in Idana looking for somebody else, and they said, well, we think Don knows where he is. Don happened to be the guy that drinks from a vodka from a Pepsi cup. We went over to him and we said, you know, we've heard this thing that so-and-so only drinks beer and you drink vodka from a Pepsi cup and you were there that night. And he said, yeah. He said, I'll tell you exactly what I told the district attorney's investigator. I drink from a vodka cup. He doesn't drink from a vodka cup. I was there. Nobody touched the little girl, of course. But we then presented that information to the district attorney and said, We we're looking for this guy. You know that this guy has information that tends to indicate that the victim in this case may have been mistaken. I'll look into it. We then subsequently, to telling him, we've talked to the witness who says he talked with your investigator, presented us with a report that said, at the direction of the deputy district attorney assigned to the case, I went out and talked to so-and-so, and he confirmed everything that we had said in that report. That information was not disclosed to us and probably would not have been disclosed to us, but for the happenstance that our investigator happened to bump into the same person. The defense does not have the resources to locate a person that police agencies do. That information resulted, we had the witness under subpoena, case went to trial and resulted in an acquittal of our client. Interestingly, he was facing Measure 11. He was looking at 75 months in prison. There was an offer for a probationary sentence, but he said, I did not do this. I want my trial. And he went to trial, and thank goodness he was acquitted of that charge. Brady information is out there. It's available. I don't know the rationale for not disclosing that report to us. It does happen. This statute will make it more clear, not only to the deputy district attorneys who are assigned to the cases, but also to police and other investigatory personnel
Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you. And I just want to say the only reason I was smiling, to think of Idana as a suburb.
I'm sorry.
It's a little bit. I think of Detroit as even smaller than that. But any further questions? Thank you very much, panel. Appreciate your testimony.
Cassie.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
I got two of the three. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Cassia Rutledge. I'm a public defender from Multnomah County. I have also practiced briefly in Washington County. My story comes from Multnomah County. A couple of years ago, I was in the middle of a trial, and on the stand, I asked the detective what I thought was an innocuous question, which was, did you record just these five conversations, or did you record all of the phone conversations that you'd had with the alleged victim? He revealed that he had recorded many, many more phone calls than had been turned over to me. It turned out he had turned over five that I had reviewed, and there were about 20 additional phone calls he had not turned over. It took him about a minute and a half to burn those CDs to a disc and for me to listen to them. On that CD were two particularly concerning phone calls. The first one was a recorded phone conversation with my own client that I had never received before. The second one was a phone conversation with the alleged victim of the case that was about 30 minutes long and revealed extremely exculpatory information. I have two very, very short clips from that, about 20 seconds each, I'm going to play for you. The male voice that you're going to hear on the tape is the detective. The female voice is the alleged victim. This phone call revealed several things. First, it revealed that the alleged victim in the case had made prior similar accusations against other people that were found to have been unfounded, not true. None of that had been revealed. It revealed that the detective knew about the incidents that led to my client being arrested, including a police report, that were never turned over to us and were extremely exculpatory. And most importantly, it revealed that the detective in the case had, as you heard him say twice, scrubbed the record so that we were not able to find the evidence on our own. After a mistrial was declared and a lengthy set over was granted, and actually new counsel came on board, my client was retried and acquitted. Because this information is not available to the defense often, and because the district attorney in this particular case said he never asked, even though I filed a discovery demand, he never asked the detective for additional discovery that had not been turned over. And the detective in the case told the court that this is his common practice to not turn over all the phone calls as a 17-year detective of the police force. I ask you to support this legislation.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
So, panel, this is for anyone. Tom, you mentioned that your client had been essentially offered a plea bargain, and considering that's the majority of cases in this state are resolved that way, if you don't have the court involved, how does this impact the plea bargain process?
Well, Representative Williamson, I think that what will affect the plea bargaining process most directly are the requirements that Brady material be disclosed immediately or as soon thereafter as revealed. And to be able to say definitively this is what the impact will be is impossible. The problem with Brady material is it exists out there. We don't know about it. We only know about it because we trust that the prosecutors and that the police investigators are more interested in convicting the right person than winning the case that they have brought. So we rely upon them to give us exculpatory information. Frequently, we will get an offer from a district attorney that either comes at an odd time or from a district attorney who is not known to give a particular offer. And all of a sudden, there's a very good offer, and we don't know why that offer happened. Probably they know something. And of course, the suspicion is always he knows something about his case that I don't know. That's what Brady material is. It's exculpatory. And so he makes us an offer that my client may or may not take based on this new information. This legislation requires that they provide that to us and provide it to us in a timely fashion. It also provides that if it is not provided prior to a negotiation being reached, that can be set aside by statute rather than now it's discretionary with the court. So it would assist in arriving at what plea negotiations are intended to do, which is achieve a fair resolution of the case.
And Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, I'd like to add something to that. I'm not sure Tom and Cassie practice civil law as well as criminal law. I practice both. And I think the important thing here is to recognize is that in civil law, the purpose of discovery, the reason discovery is so clear and so robust is because discovery resolves cases. Discovery up front is what leads to an accurate assessment of a case and leads to a case resolving in some sort of, at best, mediation. And they don't go in and they don't clog our court systems. I would submit to you that criminal discovery is no different. And statutes that clarify the discovery process in criminal cases result in cases resolving when they should. It serves the exact same purpose.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
Tom, you just mentioned a situation, by the way, it's good to see you today. You just mentioned a situation where the DA may come to you with, in a certain time, with a plea bargain and your antenna go up. At that point in time, would you ask the DA or whoever you're dealing with, do you have new information in this case that I haven't seen yet? Would you ask them that particular question?
Mr. Cameron, we do try to ask that question. The discovery process consists largely of us asking early and often for discovery in different fashion. We make, in my office, for example, we send a discovery request immediately to the district attorney when we open the file. As we get discovery, we pursue leads. If there's an indication, for example, and this happens frequently, there are photographs. There's a reference to photographs. We don't have the photographs. We have to make a demand to get those photographs. So it is an ongoing process. And yes, we would do that. You know, what is the basis of this offer? But again, without something more to go on, we're at their mercy as to whether or not they're going to share that with us.
Follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair. Please. So you would ask for any new information, discovery at that point in time, and they would have to give you, under existing law, that new information if they had anything?
Mr. Cameron, frequently, on the Brady issue, for example, for a long time we were hearing the district attorney, why didn't you give that when we find it? Why didn't you give that to us? Well, I didn't think it was Brady material. I thought I knew your theory of the case. But and this isn't exculpatory if that's your theory. Well, it's not his decision as to whether or not what my theory of the case is or whether or not something is exculpatory. Case law makes that clear. This legislation doesn't necessarily address that particular question, however.
Follow up, if I may. I'm not sure I got my question answered.
I don't think you did either.
If all of a sudden you were in a situation where you were offered a plea deal for your client, you asked for any new information, made a request, if they had new information, would they not today have to give you that information under existing law today?
They would. And under existing law, they would have to give us any information that was exculpatory. They have to give us anything that they're going to rely on in court or that would impeach that. So, for example, the document, if they were going to introduce the pictures that I have alluded to, at some point they would have to give them to us. We have had district attorneys, and my office is actually litigating a case right now on this issue, where they are, the deputy district attorney assigned to it is saying, you didn't ask in the right way. Everybody knows, and the judge has said, get the information to them. But they're challenging the manner in which we asked for it, not the legitimacy of the request, but the manner in which it was asked for. So we do ask. We ask often. Oftentimes, the results are not as we would hope.
Mr. Chair, if I would.
Please follow up.
Thank you. So if this bill was passed, we've heard testimony today of some cases that sounds like were discovered at some point in time and people were acquitted or found out. If this bill would pass, how would those change? How would those cases be changed?
Representative Cameron, for one thing, police officers don't generally know United States constitutional law. They do know the statutes. In my opinion, the change in the law, adding the Brady relevant sections to the statute, then gives the deputy district attorney more leverage to get the information that the defendant is entitled to have. The district attorney's goal should be the same as the goal of this panel and the entire criminal justice system, which is to see that justice is done. Disclosure of evidence, both inculpatory and exculpatory, is the two main tools to make that happen. So this statute would advise, would give them some leverage with the police. Look, I need to have this information. I need to disclose it. You need to give it to me. It would avoid those situations where they maybe the police officer, with good or maybe not good intention, is hiding it because, you know, he looks like he might have arrested the wrong guy if this comes out. This makes it more clear that this information must follow through the channels and into the hands of the defendant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Schmidt.
Mr. Cermak, to follow up on that line of questioning from Representative Cameron, it's not your contention, or is it, that this goes beyond current case law in Brady cases?
No, sir. This does not change current law. Regardless of what the legislation is, the constitutional requirement that the district attorney disclose information to us, the constitutional requirement that the district attorney learn of exculpatory information in the possession of the state, whether it be the police agency, his investigator, or in the file on his desk, he is required to find that and disclose that to us. This just makes it more clear, makes it clear to the courts, makes it clear to the police, makes it clear to legislators everywhere. We don't have to rely on a particular deputy district attorney who may be 2 or 3 years out of law school knowing all the nuances, and it's not very nuanced, but knowing all the requirements under Brady. It's a problem in major community, in major district attorney's offices. I would be expected it's an even bigger problem in smaller offices where they don't have the research resources and things to stay up on the law.
Chair, could I ask a question? Sort of following in the same lines, and Ms. Rutledge. Mm-hmm. So when you asked sort of the important question, were there other phone calls? So it seems to me there's a big judgment call here on what is, that term is not real familiar to me, exculpatory.
Correct.
Right? So you just happened to ask the right question, and you were sort of saying you didn't ask the question right. So in some ways, if you had asked questions about other cell phone calls, he could have given you all of his cell phone calls for the last 2 years, and you would have had to go through and find those. I guess what I'm wondering is, so the police officer or the DA has to figure out what is exculpatory, and what he or she thinks is exculpatory may be much narrower than what the defense attorney would think is exculpatory. Is that correct? And in some ways, it seems to me they could just give you reams and reams and reams of information that would not benefit you at all.
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, that is correct. And I don't think this legislation would change in terms of who decides what's exculpatory or what is turned over. In my case, it was very simple. It was a computer file he had on his desk that he literally copied and pasted over and burned to a CD. It actually took this particular detective more time to go through each of those phone calls and decide which one to turn over, instead of turning over every phone call that was a recorded statement between him and the alleged victim in the case. So in my particular case, it would have been easier and less time-consuming for the detective to have complied with his Brady obligations than to do what he did.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, and I apologize if this was already covered, but if it was, I didn't hear. Would the remedy for a violation of this new statute, if it's passed, be the same as the existing remedy for a Brady violation? Or we're not creating a new remedy, right?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, no, the statute does not create a new remedy.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Olson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Any of you can do it. I guess I'll focus more towards you, Kathy. I'm just curious what your thoughts are of the Dash 7s. Have you had a chance to see those?
I have not, but I understand that's the district attorney's recommendation. That's what's known in the...
Yes.
Yeah, okay. In my particular case, that would have, first of all, been, as we've talked about, sorry, Representative Chair Barker, Representative Olson, it would have been different than what the current constitutional case law says is the district attorney's obligation. And in my case, the district attorney did not know about these phone calls. I had filed a discovery demand, about 8-page discovery demand. The district attorney, when we went back into chambers, said to the judge, Your Honor, I had no idea these existed. And so if that was the way this law would have been written, I would have never received these phone calls unless I could convince the judge that the Constitution would trump this particular statute. And my client would have proceeded through that trial. I would not have gotten a mistrial. I would not have been able to call those additional witnesses, and he may not have been acquitted. So I think that my story and other ones are exactly why that Dash 7 amendment is not an appropriate amendment.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, panel, for your testimony. David Anglin and Dave Frohmeyer.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is David Angeli. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Portland, and I'm also an adjunct professor of law at the Lewis and Clark Law School. Hopefully we'll have our projector dialed up here in a second, but first I will say that this is the first time I've ever been involved in one of these processes of getting a bill through the legislature, and so I'm naive to the process. But having said that, this really is a head-scratcher to me as to why we're getting as much pushback as we are on this bill and why the room is as full today as it is. When Gail Meyer came to me and asked me to assist in putting together the language for this bill, the goal was really quite simple. It wasn't to grandstand. It wasn't to cast aspersions on our friends in the district attorney's offices. It was to come up with a bill that would actually pass. By using language that is tied directly to clear existing standards of conduct for district attorneys in order to address the following problem. The problem that we see in our practices is that Brady obligations are not particularly well understood by various members of law enforcement, even by certain deputy district attorney's offices or district attorneys. And those standards are applied inconsistently in district attorney's offices across the state, and sometimes even within the same DA's office, you have deputy DAs applying standards differently. And it's been an eye-opening process for me, seeing this through both the Senate side and now here on the House. Frankly, in the district attorney's own testimonies that we heard over on the Senate side, confirming that, yes, there really is an inconsistent application of these standards. And so our goal is merely this. Take the existing standards, and I'm going to walk through to demonstrate to you that each provision of this bill is tied to clear black letter law. To take those clear existing standards and put them in something that all of us will then have in front of us, defense lawyers, prosecutors, judges. So all of us know what are the standards that apply. And so we think that by doing that, you're going to get rid of this inconsistency that we see from office to office and even within offices. And deputy DAs across the state will have a clear playbook that will match the ones that the defense lawyers are using and that the courts are. So with that background, I want to walk through just briefly each element of the proposed bill and talk to you about why it is that we've included that in the legislation. So this is the preamble from the existing discovery statute. The district attorney shall disclose to a represented defendant the following material and information within the possession or control of the district attorney. That language exists today as part of the discovery statute. Subsection G adds the following information to what has to be disclosed. Any material or information that tends to exculpate the defendant, negate or mitigate the defendant's guilt or punishment, or impeach a witness the state intends to call at trial. So I want to walk through each one of those elements and just demonstrate to you or describe to you the law that we're relying on for each one of those elements. And I frankly think that the law is not in dispute on any one of these elements. I'm going to come back to the preamble language in a moment, which really is the subject of the A7 amendment. So I want to address that, but first I want to get through the specific additions to subsection G. So any material or information. The U.S. Supreme Court and the Federal Appeals Courts have been clear that Brady information includes even information that is not in and of itself admissible in a courtroom under the rules of evidence. So to the extent that there's an argument that, no, we're only going to provide you with exculpatory information that is admissible, that's clearly not the standard. Similarly, and we heard testimony from some of our district attorney friends over on the Senate side, that there are some deputy DAs who are laboring under the misimpression that if something is not written down, it's not Brady material. So if an investigator or a deputy DA were to talk to a witness and they provided information that might be helpful to the defense, there are some DAs out there who think if I just don't write it down, I don't have to turn it over to the defense. Again, that is clearly not the law. Information does not have to be reduced to documentary or tangible form in order for it to be Brady. So the language, any material or information, is meant to address those issues. It doesn't have to be admissible evidence. It doesn't have to be written down. The phrase that tends to, which precedes exculpate the defendant or negate or mitigate guilt or punishment. Again, it's drawn directly from controlling case law, including Brady itself. And this is a quote directly from the Supreme Court's opinion in Brady versus Maryland. A prosecution that withholds evidence on demand of an accused, which, if made available, would tend to exculpate him or reduce the penalty, does not comport with standards of justice. And the Oregon Rules of Professional Conduct, which guide all of us, including the district attorneys in the state, make clear that prosecutors must produce evidence that, quote, tends to negate the guilt of the accused or mitigates the offense. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has used similar language. That's obviously the circuit court that controls federal law here in Oregon. The prosecution must disclose materials that are potentially exculpatory or impeaching. So the tends to language that is part of this bill comes directly from Brady versus Maryland itself, from the ethical standards that control every prosecutor in this state, and there's really nothing going out on a limb with respect to that standard. The scope of a Brady obligation applies not only to whether or not the defendant did it, but also whether the information might tend to mitigate any punishment that might be meted out if the defendant is convicted. And again, this language is taken directly from Brady versus Maryland itself, information that relates to guilt or to punishment, and to the Ninth Circuit's subsequent case law interpreting Brady. So once again, language taken directly from controlling case law, and this is one that there aren't cases on the other side of this issue. These aren't issues where it's a close call. And then finally, as was mentioned in the last panel, Brady information also extends to information that would tend to impeach a witness. So if the state were to call, for example, a police officer who has a history of lying, and that information is within the possession of the state, that's information that needs to be turned over to the defense. It's not directly related to the defendant's innocence, but it's impeachment testimony that clearly, under controlling U.S. Supreme Court case law, has to be disclosed to the defense. So those are all the new elements that subsection G would graft onto the existing discovery statute. And really, as I say, these aren't close calls. This is existing, these are existing duties that prosecutors have today. So what about the A7 amendment? As I understand it, the district attorneys and others have suggested that information need only be disclosed under Brady if the prosecutor is actually aware of the information. And the reaction I have to that as both a lawyer who's been practicing in this area for 17 years and as a law professor is, what? Since 1995, since the Supreme Court decided the case Kyles versus Whitley, it has been controlling law everywhere in the United States, and including in Oregon, that, quote, the individual prosecutor has a duty to learn of any favorable evidence known to the others acting on the government's behalf in the case, including the police. A case decided 11 years later, Youngblood versus West Virginia, again made clear that Brady suppression occurs when the government fails to turn over even evidence that is known only to police investigators and not to the prosecutor. So federal law is just absolutely clear on this. And this is one that, again, this isn't up for debate. We could probably come in here with several hundred post-Kyles versus Whitley cases that we could put on the table here that say the same thing. And I don't think that the folks who are proposing Amendment A7 could come up with a single post-Kyles case that says anything to the contrary. And the federal standard, by the way, is also consistent with existing Oregon law. In State versus Warren, the Oregon Supreme Court, before Kyles was ever decided on the federal side, made clear that the prosecutor is responsible for evidence in the possession of the police, even if it was not in the prosecutor's physical possession. So every single element of what has been proposed in SB 492 is tied to clear existing law. And can I also say, with respect to amendment the A7 amendment, just as kind of a common sense point, if I, as a defense lawyer, in a civil case, were to get a request for production of documents from my opponent, or if I were to accept service of a grand jury subpoena on behalf of a corporate client, it wouldn't even dawn on me to call my opponent and say, okay, I'm only going to produce to you those documents that I, the lawyer, am aware of. Right? I mean, everyone would laugh at that notion. Of course I have a duty to go to my client and ask them what responsive materials they have in their possession, which I then take and turn over to my opponent. And it seems to me that we should ask nothing less, particularly in light of the existing state of the law, of prosecutors to go to the police agencies and make some good faith effort to ensure that they've obtained anything that might be producible under Brady versus Maryland, Kyles versus Whitley, and the other cases that we've discussed here today. So with that, I hope that the committee, Chair Barker, is satisfied that SB 492 would not expand the scope of existing law. There were a couple of questions asked, one by Council Schmidt. Would this fix the problem? And the candid answer is no, it wouldn't fix the problem. I don't think that any piece of legislation that is passed here fixes the problem that it's aimed at. But would it tend to make the problem better? I believe it would. If all of us had clearly articulated standards that are derived from controlling law, I think that the instances of Brady violations would be reduced, perhaps dramatically. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I have a question. Do you think it would be helpful if we were to direct the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to come up with a statewide program to be sure that police officers are trained in the basics of this early on and even later on as far as that goes, in some kind of a statewide architecture. Because obviously, training Portland Police is different than training Harney County. And so, do you think it would be helpful if we had essentially DPSST come up with a statewide program to be sure Brady was clearly understood?
I do. I think a training program for law enforcement and new district attorneys would be a critical component of this. I believe that a statutory standard that guided that training and was really the anchor of it would be the critical first step, which would hopefully then be incorporated into a training program to get the word out and ensure that everyone's working off the same sheet of music.
Fromeyer.
Thank you very much, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dave Fronemeyer. I am a law professor at the University of Oregon. I'm of counsel of Harang Long, Gary and Rudnick, and Eugene. I have served as Attorney General of Oregon, and I was privileged one time a long time ago for three sessions to sit in the chairs that you now occupy and to make these kinds of decisions. I say that only by way of identification purposes and a disclaimer. I represent none of those institutions here today. I'm not a member of the Oregon Criminal Defense Association or any of them, and I'm not compensated for this appearance. It is pro bono publico, and it's on the basis that it's my hope that you will codify the Brady decision. If I can leave you with nothing else, it is, I hope, at least the notion that I come by my views of Brady honestly. So it's a little bit autobiographical, but let me say that very nearly, not exactly the 50th anniversary of Brady's decision, but about its 45th, I, as a brand new admitted lawyer working for a large corporate law firm in California, but the very day I was admitted to the California Bar, the Federal District Court appointed me to a pro bono case, which my firm happily allowed us to take, to represent a prisoner in San Quentin. His claim was a Brady violation. And I must say that any time that one sees a client, particularly in these early formative years, and you hear the clang of the door of a maximum security prison behind you, you know that it's serious. My client had already been in prison for a year. In fact, he was in segregation because he was of his views, was highly racially charged. Prisons, as we all know, are dangerous places, and he'd already been doing very hard time. His claim, which the district court believed was serious enough to call for an evidentiary hearing, was that the prosecutor, in pursuing a drug trafficking claim against him, had used a confidential informant before the grand jury, and then had not only dismissed the grand jury, but dismissed whatever hold the prosecution had on the confidential informant, who immediately left the jurisdiction and was unavailable. As a consequence, one of the major persons whose truthfulness could have been explored, whose exculpatory evidence might have been available, was gone. My client was convicted. We prevailed in federal district court. I had asked the state actually to confess error based upon, even though it was only 5 years or so old at the time, the Brady violation seemed clear. The appellate prosecutor was a very nice guy, but he declined. They took it to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit, in a case called Hernandez versus Nelson, decided in 1968 or 69, and it is still good law in this circuit, upheld the writ of habeas corpus. But by then, my client had served another year and a half of hard time in the face of what clearly was a violation of his constitutional rights under a case which has never been dismissed, has never been questioned as to whether it constitutes the constitutional law of the United States. You have before you this Senate bill, which has been much discussed, as I understand. It is in accordance with the standards that apply to prosecutors and to lawyers generally. The level best is done by the framers of the measure, and I've talked to them because I said, I don't want to come here to Salem and testify in favor of a bill that changes the law or adds some secret ingredient or create some new loophole above and beyond the constitutional learning of Brady. And I've been assured by my colleagues who have been at the rostrum with me today that their intention is to codify Brady. So if one needs a statement of legislative intention, at least this witness asserts to you that I believe that to be the intention of this measure that is before you. But why should you do that? You've heard some of the reasons, so let me just briefly recapitulate. I know time is pressing on you all, and the district attorneys should rightfully be heard from. But first of all, a statute allows you to read the words. We do not require, should not require, police officers, district attorneys, or for that matter, defense attorneys, to be constitutional law professors and engage in the arcane theology that American constitutional law sometimes is. So a far better thing simply to put in the words of a statute, which is available and accessible to everyone, the obligations which our criminal justice system said are our constitutional rights. The second is the cards are face up on the table. That's the purpose of the Brady rule. No secrets. Let's deal with the criminal justice problem and the rights of the accused and the problems of the accused based upon what really happened and what the state has. Not a mother may I or a gotcha type situation where there's the old sporting theory of justice that's characterized sometimes on Perry Mason. That hasn't been the rule in this state of the United States now for many years, even though some people seem to celebrate it. A third point, raised really by the question that Representative Williamson posed a few moments ago, which is, it is at least my subjective belief, based upon some years of observation of the criminal justice system, that the plea bargaining system, which after all disposes of 80 or 90% of the cases that arise in the criminal justice system, actually be assisted by this process. Assisted in part because of a factor that hasn't really been mentioned, but I suspect operates, and that is that a client who is informed by his or her lawyer that this is what the state really has against you, pro and con, is more likely to be persuaded by a dialogue with his or her own lawyer than if there's a belief that there's a sporting theory out there and a chance that something will be sprung that no one's heard of yet. Of course, you've heard testimony that a majority of the states, actually nearly 60% of the states, have already codified this rule. So there isn't anything that's shocking about Oregon joining with its sister states in trying to bring some sense and articulation to this. It isn't some secret edition, or at least I'm here to tell you that I do not believe there's any secret edition to the law that's somehow being blown by this committee and its very good lawyers and assistants. I think it makes the remedy simpler. Without a need to bring a constitutional claim under Section 1983. You have a statute with words to read that rather more clearly, perhaps, and obviously spell out obligations. And finally, as Professor and Counsel Angelini and others have told you, this isn't strange to the American legal system. In the part-time work that I do of counsel with a law firm, it's routine in civil discovery that you give what you have. And then you tell your client to fork it over so that the process of assessing the worth of a case or a matter is accessible to everyone. So I hope I persuaded the committee at least that my views on this are honest and consistent for nearly a half century, and I do urge you to pass this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Frommeyer, thank you so much for coming to Salem and lending your views and experience to this process, coming back to Salem. The discussion has yet to take a direction that I'm very curious in learning about and any thoughts you may have, which is the perspective of the courts to the kind of proposal that this bill contains. In other words, codifying the case law into a statute. Would this, if you care to comment or not, do you have any thoughts on whether this would be a help, a hindrance, an indifferent proposal, or any of the above regarding from the perspective of the courts, the judges who are deciding these cases, both at the trial level and the appellate level? Because ultimately, that's who this is going to come in front of routinely. And so is codifying case law into a statute good or bad from the perspective of the courts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hicks, any views necessarily subjective. The only black robe I put on is at commencement rather than in a judicial capacity. But I would think that it would be helpful to the court because there's something in the Oregon Revised Statutes that you can point to and say, is this subsection A, B, or C? As opposed to, now let's see, what's the latest parsing of Brady versus Maryland in the Seventh Circuit, or more relevantly, the Ninth Circuit. I think the bench would welcome it. And to segue back to the very helpful question that Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker posed, this would provide a vehicle, a template for police, prosecutor, for that matter, defense attorney training, where you can really see what the words say. as opposed to try to look for a law review article. It's the latest analysis of the Brady Doctrine. So my view is at least marginally it helps.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Representative, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Frommer, I have a question about the A7 amendments. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at them, but they're the amendments that would insert known to the district attorney into the statutory language or into the bill language. And my concern is that we would be, if we adopted these amendments, we would be adopting a statute that actually isn't reflective of what the duty is. And I'm wondering, and maybe Mr. Angeli, you've looked at these and thought about it, so either to either of you. My concern is that we would be putting in those clarifying words, the playbook that everyone would be using, language that's not actually the state of the law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Williamson, I think you heard Mr. Angelini's remarks, and I would align myself with him that the present law goes well beyond that minimal requirement. But putting aside the A7 amendments in some technical sense, it changes the focus of what the debate is about from what happened to the defendant, what's the constellation of things that cause someone to judge whether he or she's guilty or innocent, to what's in the head of the prosecution. And that's the wrong direction to look. That's not what the issue is. Did the defendant do it or not? What as opposed to psychoanalyzing the degree of the prosecutor's culpability, which it seems to be not only the wrong inquiry, but would turn Brady inquiries into what potentially could be a demoralizing examination of prosecutors' motives. So in my view, the stronger method to proceed is the one suggested by Mr. Angelini.
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, I share a concern with codifying a clearly unconstitutional standard as well. And might I say, in addition, that some of the opposition to the language that we have proposed, I think, kind of sets up a straw man argument, which is this would impose on prosecutors kind of an unworkable duty. Would it impose on them, for example, the obligation to go out to private witnesses and start to try to develop exculpatory information? I think one of the emails that I've seen flying around says, if I've got a rape victim, for example, do I have to go to her sister and say, has she made any inconsistent statements to you, so that I would have to turn that over to the defense? The short answer to that question is no. The standard that would be imposed on a prosecutor is the standard that is set out in Kyles versus Whitley, is a duty to learn favorable evidence known to the others acting on the government's behalf in the case, including the police. Government representatives who are working with the district attorney's office on the particular case. That's the extent of the duty. And the federal body of case law on this is extensive and clear. And it's a workable standard at the federal level. It's a workable standard in the district attorney's offices who are faithfully applying that standard today. And it should be a workable standard going forward.
Excellent. Just a follow-up comment, which is, I think if the goal of codifying these rules is so that the standard is clear to everyone, I'm concerned that we have an amendment in front of us that would actually codify something that is not the standard. So.
Okay, thank you very much. Josh Marquis, Eric Nislex, and Jeff Howes, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Joshua Marquis. I'm the district attorney in Clatsop County. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I also served 2 years as a capital defense lawyer, which is an unusual thing to do in the middle of your career as a prosecutor. So I've been on both sides of the table. I also scratched my head about this bill, but it's sort of, I think, I don't know if Representative Tomei was getting at this. I wondered why this bill was necessary at all. And the reason Mr. Angelus says he just can't understand, well, at his testimony before the Senate, he made it quite clear that what he would like to see is essentially the rules of discovery in civil cases, which I think several of you have practiced civil law, which are much broader. I believe the words he used was broad-ranging subpoenas, the ability to depose. We don't have that in this state, but I think that is probably the intention. If, in fact, what 492 was merely an attempt to codify the existing case law in Brady, Kyles versus Whitley, and its progeny, you wouldn't see opposition from prosecutors. Now, I'm just going to ask a couple of rhetorical questions. I know that the chair, the ranking member, and at least one other member are police, or veteran police officers. And I guess I would ask yourselves, or when you talk about it, based on the testimony, can you really say that you all never heard of Brady, and you never had discussions with prosecutors about what your obligations were? I think the answer to that is no. And I know a number of you are members of the Oregon State Bar. I want to talk briefly, because our time is running out and there are other people here, about why this matters. And I have a handout that compares the language, and language matters enormously. And yes, what this does is this takes bits and pieces out of some of these cases and expands it greatly. And Ms. Meyer, I think when she started saying, well, this is really just about whether you adopt the Dash 7. No. The DA's Association, and certainly I personally, think this is a bad bill. I frankly looked and I saw that it passed 29-0. I listened to the hearings. I live a couple hundred miles away, so I can't always come. And I was struck by what appeared to me to be a pitch of, this is no big deal. This is just adopting the existing statute. And who could possibly object to that? And then there was a litany, worse than today, but still the theme was, well, I'm not saying prosecutors do bad things, but let me tell you some horror stories. Well, when Professor Frohmeyer was my constitutional law professor my first year in law school, one of the things I learned was constitution from statute. And as you all know, for example, let's take something like victims' rights, which we fought for. We got in 1986 in statute, but that wasn't good enough because constitutional rights of the defendant trumped victims' rights. So in 1999, voters approved that. It's very rare you go the other direction, because no matter what statute you pass, judges, I think somebody asked this question, will turn, I think it was you, Representative Hicks, will turn to the law to determine it. And let me give you a couple of very real-world examples of what happens and how Brady works. Prosecutors and defense attorneys have radically different duties. I've been both. A prosecutor's job, and I think the defense would agree, is to seek justice, not merely convictions. I don't even measure in my office the conviction rate. I don't judge lawyers by that. And my deputies are free to dismiss cases without fear of me jumping down their throat, as long as there's, you know, some good reason, and it doesn't have to be that they can't prove it. There may be other equities. A defense lawyer's job is not to, you know, equally seek the truth. It's to vigorously represent their client. And unfortunately, I would have to disagree with the inestimable professor and attorney general, President Frohmeyer, a trial is not a search for the truth. A trial is whether the state has enough evidence to prove it or not. And that's why a lot more people get acquitted than probably actually did it. That's the way it's supposed to work. And one of the questions also asked was, well, what is exculpatory? Well, I can tell you as a prosecutor that the view is usually by the defense lawyer, what's exculpatory is whatever we didn't give them, no matter how arcane and how bizarre. I live in a county medium-sized. I have 6 deputies. I have 7 police agencies. When a murder takes place, all 7 police agencies are involved. I know from trying capital cases and from reading them and debating this, I am currently the vice chair of the American Bar Association's Criminal Justice Section. I just came from a conference where we were discussing Brady. The reason there are not more DAs here, by the way, is right now there's a training session going on over at DPSSD about formulating more Brady training. I cannot tell you as a prosecutor, as a working prosecutor, how seriously we take Brady and what the consequences are, and I'll give you 2 very real-world examples on either side. Let me use a bad one first that's embarrassing. Came from my office. I've been the DA for 19 years, and I've worked in 3 other DA's offices in Oregon, 2 as chief deputy and 1 as a deputy DA. And what happened is one of my senior deputy DAs was trying an elder abuse case. And there was a question about whether or not there were 3 critical witnesses had their interviews recorded. And he claimed that the recordings that he had were they were basically worthless. He couldn't hear anything. And he produced those tapes. But the judge was suspicious that there might be something else and asked the officers, is there another tape? And it turned out there was. She I went in, represented. I told my deputy to apologize. I demanded to know how that came about. I asked the judge to throw me in jail and as a sanction or fine me. Do anything but suppress the evidence, because if the evidence were suppressed, then these people who beat this old woman to death were going to get away with it. The judge ruled, and she was entirely within her rights and within the law, that no, the sanction for a willful discovery violation was exclusion of the witnesses, and which was a functional dismissal, which was, of course, on the front page of the daily newspaper. And partially as a result of that, I ended up discharging that deputy DA. As lawyers, and I know four of you are, the one thing that you probably are more scared of is getting a letter that looks like this, because this is not on video. This is by the way, I was the complainant in this particular one, but this is a letter on the letterhead of the Oregon State Bar, and in the left-hand corner, it says personal and confidential, and all of you who are lawyers know what I'm talking about. Your mouth goes dry when you get one of these, because without passing this statute, the Brady law consequences are enormous. They are losing your ticket. I mean, permanently. And I speak, by the way, as someone who became DA because my predecessor was arrested, indicted, convicted, jailed, and disbarred, not for a Brady violation, but there are very real-world consequences. So not only do we have the incentive, presumably we're doing the right thing for the right reasons. If we don't, the bar will come after us with an axe. And let me give you another example that I'm going to deliberately omit the jurisdiction because these prosecutors were essentially wrongfully accused. It was a large jurisdiction. One of you, maybe even the chair, might even know which case I'm talking about. It's a prosecution of an allegedly corrupt police officer. And the investigator from the Internal Affairs Bureau, the defense attorney, somehow heard a rumor that there might be some misconduct involving that, and made a discovery demand of the DA. So the DA didn't, and by the way, when we do these cases, we write memos. We write multiple memos. We say, we need every piece of paper. I do open file discovery. In murder cases, it's not worth it. And by the way, there is no real reciprocal discovery in Oregon, because under State versus Ben and other things, the reason you're not going to read about cases where there's defense misconduct is there is no remedy. The only remedy available is, Mr. Markey, you can have 2 extra hours, or maybe one day. There's simply, if the prosecution doesn't turn it over, it can be exclusion, dismissal, criminal prosecution. If the defense doesn't do it, even though it's theoretical, it's like, okay, would you need an extra day or two? And I'm not suggesting that it should be another way, but let's just be realistic about this. But let me get back to this Multnomah County case. So what do these prosecutors do? They don't just write a memo. They get a sworn affidavit from the captain in charge of the IA division that says no such complaint exists, and it couldn't, and it didn't, and they relied on this, and the bar went after them nonetheless, because the standard, as somebody pointed out, isn't just known; it's we should have known. And then the question is, and this matters a lot: how do you know? How deeply do you have to go? You clearly have to find out whether the cop did anything wrong in the case. What about the cop doing wrong in his last job? What about whether the cop, and I, my colleagues are going to address this, what if he cheated on an exam in school? Don't you have a duty to look into that? What if there's rumors in the community that he's a liar? Mr. Antles, I think, ridiculed the idea that you'd have to investigate. You wouldn't just have to investigate. You have to warn the victims. Oh, by the way, there's a rumor that you're a drug abuser. We're going to subpoena all of your medical records and all your prescription records, because as a defense lawyer, and I was one, I think that they may have been affected by something. So what ended up happening with this case in this mythical jurisdiction from a large Oregon county was that a number of us, like DAs like myself, did affidavits to the state bar saying we would have done exactly the same thing. We would have relied on an sworn affidavit from the head of a division in the police department. I believe in that case the defendant was found not guilty. I know time. I would point out that both in the hearings in the Senate and the hearings today, the anecdotes you've been told all seem to have happy endings for the defense at the trial level. Now, I'm very involved in the national level in the discussion about wrongful convictions, whether the death penalty is fair, innocence, and I think it's proper to look and say, okay, do we have a problem? And so the question is, what is 492? Is it a problem in search of a solution, or is it a solution in search of a problem? Because I haven't heard, in both listening to the Senate version or what's heard today, examples of Oregon appellate cases, Oregon Supreme Court cases, Ninth Circuit cases that talk about this has got to end, you know, this proliferation of deliberate or even negligent, because it doesn't have to be deliberate, prosecutorial either just laziness or malice in not turning things over. This just, I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but there are the existing law which controls and which will continue to control, provides prosecutors a huge disincentive to do the wrong thing and an enormous incentive to do the right thing. So I would ask you very carefully to look at this language, and I think Mr. Nisley and the other people, and I want to be clear that just because there's just two elected DAs here, there are several other meetings, including this meeting about Brady. In any event, there's a number of other things I'd like to say, but we don't have enough time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Garrett.
Josh, maybe they're going to speak to it, but I didn't really hear you explain how the language in the bill goes beyond what is required by current case law.
Well, I'm probably going to let Mr. Howes discuss that. I mean, one of the really big ones is when do you disclose it? And as somebody, as I think Representative Williamson pointed out correctly, 94% on an average of criminal cases are not resulted in result trial. They're as pleas. So the argument presumably would be, you better, prosecutors, have all of this exculpatory information, or not just exculpatory, anything that might even assist the defendant, and you better have it on the front end. So you better, by the way, be prepared to give us all investigators, because we're going to need them to be able to unearth that information.
And what year was Brady?
50 years ago, 1963 or 64.
And you're talking about the place. I don't remember that term, the Brady thing, but from the earliest days know that I had to tell it, present everything.
Right, and correct me if I'm wrong, Chair Barker, but I'm assuming that when you were a police officer, that if, for example, a witness came in and said, you know, I'm not sure about that, I changed my mind, you knew that you absolutely had to go to the prosecutor and say, hey, they've had kind of a change of heart, or they've vacillated on the identification.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
I came on the department June 1 of 64, never heard the word. But we were taught what honesty, integrity, and forthright conduct was. I can guarantee you the department taught you that. If you didn't know that, by the time you got out of there, you were fired. So, but the requirement to disclose to the degree that you're saying it, I don't remember ever hearing that at any school I ever attended with the state police. It was just that you always were honest. This is your notebook. Everything's in there. So this looks like this goes... there's an obligation a little beyond that, and that's why I think Chair Barker is looking at, hey, we need to get some training at BPST to make sure those officers understand that, you know, honesty, integrity, all that's fine, but this is an addition that you need to be able to articulate and make sure that people know.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, I think you're right, but and it may well be that you didn't know Brady, but you understood exactly what the core issue was, which is don't hide anything. Anything that the defense lawyer might want or that would cast any kind of doubt on what maybe the first impression of the case was or the pet theory of the prosecutor or the cop has to be turned over. It's not supposed to be trial by ambush, at least certainly not from the state standpoint. And I think that's implicit in what you just said.
I know that you said BPST, which hasn't been that for about 20 years. But
well, there wasn't anything. We had a police academy, state police. There was no central training.
Yeah. Look at this, you. Please. Go ahead. Next.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Eric Nisley, Wasco County District Attorney. I've been the district attorney for about 14 years. I was in the office as a deputy for about 2 years. And before that, I worked as a criminal defense attorney in Multnomah County. I've been involved in the law pretty much continuously since 1988. With all due respect to Mr. Frohnmayer and people who I believe are well-intended, it's our position and our belief, which will be more thoroughly outlined by Mr. Howes, that this bill goes far beyond what the current Constitution requires. And I urge you to take good care and caution and think carefully before you start codifying things that multiple courts have explained. They're asking you, via anecdote, to write down in legislation what a series of cases that take pages and pages and pages and many judges, many hours and many days and years to simply codify that rapidly, because they believe, and probably earnestly and honestly, that this does not expand the law. We believe it does. We believe this will have a chilling effect on people coming forward to report crimes, or once they find out that the breadth and depth of where the defense can go and what they can find out about you and what they can put on the stand necessarily, or at least get and use against you, is very concerning. And I drove all the way over here from the Dalles. Dalles is a very small town. There's a lot of small towns in the state where something like this, where I believe, for example, if your house was burglarized and I have to call you as a witness, you weren't even there, but you have to come in and testify what you remember in your house that was stolen. Now, it's my belief that based on this statute as it's written, it would be fairly simple for the defense to either require us to go and look at your pharmaceutical records if they believe that you have a addiction to pain pills, because that would affect your ability to remember what was taken. That would impeach your credibility, your ability to perceive and to recollect and to disclose on the stand. Opinions as to reputation for truthfulness. Each of you as an elected official, we would have to call your opponents in your elections to would say that you were not a truthful person in their opinion.
Put that down.
This goes far, far beyond what the statutes, the case law requires now. So I would urge you to very carefully and thoughtfully listen to people that have prepared. I'm not prepared to address those questions about the breadth and depth. We do have someone here to address that. So we are urging you to not pass this on. And I would just point out to you that the people that you are hearing from are lawyers. And lawyers are dedicated to the principle of persuasion. And the information that I heard from the defense and Mr. Frohnmayer was very persuasive. I mean, it sounded really good. It really did. And that's why they present it that way. They're trying to persuade you. That's what lawyers do. But good lawyers can disagree. And as Mr. Frohnmayer said, he is not wearing a black robe. It's not up to them to interpret this. It's not up to those people who are good-intentioned, I believe, to interpret this statute. It's up to the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. They are the ones who are going to interpret this language, not you, not the defense bar, and certainly not the prosecution as well. So if you have a group of lawyers who are telling you that this is not changing, and another group of lawyers who are telling you that this does change the statute, I would urge you to think carefully about how a court of appeals or the Supreme Court might view this. Because you can expand beyond the Constitution what the law requires the state to do. And I would urge you not to do that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question?
Yes, sure,
thank you. So, Mr. Nestle, is that correct?
Yes.
So, you don't have the bill in front of you. Does anyone have it there? Could you show me what lines in particular you're concerned about?
I'm going to. Chair Barker and Representative Tomei.
Thank you.
I'm going to defer most of those questions to Mr. House. He's.
Well, you made some pretty important statements.
One thing that's very concerning is that we have to immediately provide that. And immediate is right now.
Yeah.
And we don't have that information frequently. Somebody gets arrested on Monday.
Could you show me that line?
Yeah, it's lines 16 and 17.
On the front page, first page?
Page 2.
page 2?
Subsection 3.
16 and 17. Isn't
yes.
this current
16
one?
And 17. That's 1.
Chris, isn't
any engrossed
points
on
tell me which line
page 2
16 and 17
lines 1 and 2
bill is,
lines 1 and 2 on the A engrossed
and the bolded
sorry
section.
Could you say that again? Appears to be lines 1 and 2 on the A engrossed
the first page
on page 2
page 2
lines 1 and 2 on the A engrossed.
In the interest of time, I would encourage you to defer the questions on the technical aspects of this to Mr. House.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Mr. House.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Jeff House. I'm the first assistant to Multnomah County District Attorney Rod Underhill. I want to speak specifically about three issues with this bill today. First and foremost, and you've heard it and thoughtful questions have been asked about it, is the necessity of this bill and why would we want to codify what I see and what I think most lawyers see as a fluid case law. I want to just point out, and Ms. Myers, or the OCDLA's handout, is actually quite informative to both sides of this issue, and I urge a careful reading of it. At the top of it states that the Brady duty provides that the suppression by the prosecution of evidence favorable to and requested by an accused violates due process. We all agree with that. I don't know how we couldn't. But suppression is an action verb. Suppression doesn't happen in a vacuum. Suppression has to be an intentional act. Brady says the intentional withholding, that is suppression. I don't suppress things by inaction. I suppress things by action. To suggest that this bill does not do anything but codify Brady, I just have to respectfully disagree with some very smart people on the other side of this issue. Because what this bill says, and I'm now trying to speak to Representative Tomei's question, any material or information that tends to exculpate the defendant. That statement in and of itself presumes a sort of omniscience on the part of the prosecution that is simply unattainable. Any information or material, how can a prosecutor live up to that standard? It's aspirational, it's goal-worthy, but unfortunately, it's not functional in the real world. I urge a critical review of this document because, as one would not expect any less from Ms. Meyer and the people working for her, they've done a good job of capturing a lot of the Brady-type language in the 50 states of our nation. A lot of these quoted statutes in this document do not come from the equivalent of the Oregon Revised Statutes. They are rules of criminal procedure or they are court rules. Rules of criminal procedure and court rules are not codifications in statutes. The court rules in Oregon are drafted and proposed and put forth by the Oregon Supreme Court. I want to point just to a couple, and we've talked about a lot of them, but let's talk about our neighbors. Let's talk about California and let's talk about Washington. And I don't like to be read to you, but I'm going to ask your indulgence so we can get this on the record. The California Penal Code, so this is a statute in California, says that the prosecuting attorney shall disclose to the defendant or his or her attorney all of the following materials or information if it is in the possession of the prosecuting attorney or in the possession or the prosecuting attorney knows it to be in the possession of the investigating agency. That's from our neighbor to the south. Our neighbor to the north, in their statute, which is a rule of criminal procedure, says the prosecuting attorney's obligation under this section is limited to material and information within the knowledge, possession, or control of members of the prosecuting attorney's staff. Those are just two examples of the language in this document put forth by the OCDLA, and it's replete with examples of language that we're suggesting in the -7A amendment known to the prosecution. Interestingly, and I like hearing Mr. Angeli speak, he's very intelligent and articulate, he mentioned a standard of obtaining the knowledge that is necessary to be turned over, and he said there should at least be a good faith effort to ascertain Brady material. But in this document, the engrossed A. Engrossed Senate Bill 492, there's not a standard for how or when the prosecution would get this information. And I've asked good friends on the defense side, how does this bill work? What does this bill do? And I haven't gotten a clear answer on A, what it does different than what we already do, or B, another answer I've gotten is send a letter. Send a letter to your investigating agency. And I paused at that because that strikes me as form over substance. To send a letter to the Portland Police Bureau, which provides my office with 20,000 cases a year, saying, oh, by the way, Chief Reese, please provide me with all exculpatory information, is going to land on his desk, maybe get filtered out through an all-inbox email, and it's not going to have a practical effect. Is this a training issue? Of course it is. Is it a training issue with DPSST? Yes. Is it a training issue with young prosecutors? Yes. Are both of those things currently occurring? Yes. Should they continue and get better? Yes. But to codify or to enact this statute, which says any material or information, is simply too broad to be workable and too broad to be effective. I want to leave you with this, because we've heard about Brady and its progeny. We've heard about case law and what it commands prosecutors to do. And I just want to highlight sort of the danger of cherry-picking quotes out of a constitutional case and using it to support your position. And to highlight that, with apologies, I'm going to read some of the language from Kyles v. Whitley. And here's what it says. This is from the majority opinion in Kyles v. Whitley. And remember, it was a plurality opinion. It wasn't a majority. It wasn't a unanimous decision. It was a plurality. Some of the justices agreed with some of the parts of it, some agreed with others, and some dissented. We have never held that the Constitution demands an open file policy, however such policy might work out in practice. And the rule in Bagley, and hence in Brady, requires less of the prosecution than the ABA standards for criminal justice, which call generally for prosecutorial disclosures of any evidence tending to exculpate and mitigate. The quote goes on to then quote those ABA standards and the ABA model rule of professional conduct. A prosecutor should not intentionally fail to make timely disclosure to the defense at the earliest feasible opportunity of the existence of all evidence or information which tends to negate the guilt of the accused or mitigate the offense charged or which would tend to reduce punishment of the accused. The ABA model rule, this is the rule that guides every lawyer in the country, states the prosecutor in a criminal case shall make timely disclosure to the defense of all evidence or information known to the prosecutor that tends to negate the guilt of the accused or mitigates the offense. Known to the prosecutor is in our model rule in this nation. I urge you to carefully consider what this bill says now and the small change that is suggested in the 7A amendment, which makes it workable, which makes it practical, which does actually codify something which will get results. And I thank you all for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. House, hello. So are you able to comment on the case with the recordings that we heard earlier? It was a Multnomah County case. Would you be able to flesh out a little more of what happened there?
Ms. Rutledge was very clear that the prosecutor didn't know that this detective had been recording phone calls. And had no idea until it was divulged on the stand. I can only take at face value what has been said that the prosecutor didn't know. I guess what I didn't hear, sir, and what is left to speculation in that example, and I would imagine many other examples, is what exactly was exculpatory about that. I heard that the officer on the recording said, I'm going to scrub information that you've made allegations. We have a duty beyond just exculpatory information to turn over impeachable information, and we have a well-oiled machine to do just that, and we do that in Multnomah County. Was that a bad case? Is that a bad example? Yes, very much so. I like to think that with regard to that case, that a good lawyer like Ms. Rutledge and an honest prosecutor like the one in that case called a halt to the proceedings. You didn't hear that the prosecutor tried to grind on with what was clearly now a flawed court case, backed off, time was taken, information retrieved and disclosed, and the case went forward and reached the result that you heard it reached. I can't speak any more to it than that. Had it been known, I have to rely upon my office's training and experience to think that it would have been disclosed.
I'd go one step further, Representative Hicks. That almost sounded criminal. I mean, if I don't know what scrubbing meant, but if it meant going in and changing government records and removing them, I've acted as a special prosecutor across this country, and I've prosecuted police officers, and so we're not just talking about a Brady violation if it's as bad as it was put forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on line 25 on the first page, any material information as the measure of material in this bill, how is that different than the rule articulated in Price that the government should disclose all evidence? Is that a larger body of material or information?
Well,
any and all?
Chair Barker and Representative Williamson, I've read U.S. v. Price, a Ninth Circuit case, but I can't. In that case, the prosecutor did what is required at the front end. He asked the investigator to pull records of witnesses and then didn't follow up with that investigator to see, A, if that had been done, and B, was there exculpatory information. And the prosecutor was soundly thumped by the Ninth Circuit for not following up on that. Does that mean that the dicta contained in U.S. v. Price has become something by which we should measure our discovery statutes? I would urge you that it shouldn't. Brady and constitutional law is still evolving and still changing, and a command that the prosecutor turn over all evidence is, again, simply unworkable. A prosecutor does not, A, have all evidence, B, have access to all evidence, or C, have the ability to corral it and turn it over. I think, again, it's aspirational language.
Mr. Chair, follow up. So you're contending that the universe of evidence to be turned over and the timing at which the evidence is turned over are the two places that this bill expands the Brady rule?
I am.
Okay. And one final comment, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm concerned with the comparison of an ABA standard and to a constitutional rule in this area about how prosecutors should be seeking out evidence and turning over evidence, and I just see those as very different things around how if the rule is broken, what the remedy is.
Chair Barker and Representative Williamson, I understand your question, and I don't disagree with it. I brought out that language in my testimony to highlight that even contained within one U.S. Supreme Court case, there seems to be conflicting directives. Now, with regard to what a prosecutor should know, could know, or will know, I turned back to the OCDLA exhibit, and I looked specifically at the Colorado language, which is, again, a rule of criminal procedure, not a statutory rule. But at the bottom of the page, and they're not numbered, but it's under Colorado, it says, the prosecuting attorney shall use diligent, good faith efforts to cause such material to be made available. Well, that's nowhere in the language drafted by the OCDLA and put forth. And I wondered why, and I had to fall on the suggestion that less is better in this particular instance because it opens it up to a broader interpretation of any information. I'd be happy to, explore with my friends on the defense side, further sort of edification of that. But right now, the bill doesn't say that. It doesn't say good faith. It doesn't say must provide, must produce, or must investigate. It just says any evidence.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up? But even if Colorado has it codified in a rule, it could be a lesser standard that they've articulated in their rule than what the Constitution requires or what the court says the Constitution requires.
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, I don't disagree with that statement. I think that's true. But what are we trying to do here? It seems to me that this bill doesn't just codify Brady. It goes way beyond it. It creates a duty much beyond Brady. Either we're trying to codify Brady, we're trying to make our discovery statutes more clear, or we're trying to go beyond that. It's my view here today that this goes even beyond Brady and what follows from Brady.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Garrett, please.
So I've been listening and trying, and I think failing to understand how the phrase any material information expands beyond what you're required to do by case law. You've referred to it as aspirational, and it does have kind of an open-ended sound to it, I agree. But it seems like it's more of a semantic issue than a real one, because if you end up in a case where a defendant is arguing that the prosecution has failed to produce material or information that tended to exculpate him, unless the case law has been totally misrepresented to us, that's a Brady violation. And so I don't see how just using the phrase any material or information in statute creates any new exposure for the prosecutor that the case law doesn't already create. Does that question make sense?
Sir, it does. Chair Barker and Representative Garrett, I believe I understand your question, and I guess my response would be this. Brady talks about suppression of evidence. And I opened with suppression is an overt act. Any material, if a defendant came in the real world, in a courtroom in Multnomah County where I practice, if a defendant came and said, I believe that there is information out there and it's not been turned over to me. Unless I had some inkling of that, the existence of such information, how could I be in violation of Brady or anything else? It's my position that any material or information is simply too broad. It asks for the moon and the stars when we're working in the real world and doing our best to provide all information known to the prosecution.
Follow up. So I think what Mr. Angeli would say in response is, no, Kyles v. Whitley limits. Suppression isn't just active suppression. It's violation of a duty to learn of any favorable evidence known to the others acting on the government's behalf. So is it your argument that that language in the Whitley case is not controlling in terms of defining what suppression means?
It is, but I want to qualify that, Representative Garrett. My reading of Whitley is that language is in contradiction to language two pages ahead of it, which says that the rule in Bagley and hence Brady requires less than the ABA standards of criminal justice. So it requires less than that, and the rule, ABA rule of criminal justice, says that the prosecutor should not intentionally fail to make timely disclosure. Trying to codify something that was written in 1963 and then has been analyzed over and over and over again leads to a problematic scenario where we don't know where to land today and we don't know what the case law is going to say tomorrow or next week or next month. We have the standard. We abide by the standard to the best of our ability. With these examples, which I don't make excuses for, but they happen in a big and busy system. When violations occur, they're dealt with at the trial court level. If not at the trial court level, at the appellate level. But to say that a prosecutor must turn over any material or information without limit is simply an unworkable standard.
Representative
Hicks. Thank you.
So, I'm looking at page one, lines five through seven. The existing discovery statute, 135.815, paragraph 1, that we're seeking to amend.
and I'll read it. It says, except as otherwise provided by reference statutes, the district attorney shall disclose to a represented defendant the following material information, and then within the possession or control of the district attorney. And then down lower, we do reference the very controversial any material. But see, I'm, please help me on this. I'm seeing this already as being a confinement that's currently in statute that is not going to change with this bill. This any in material information, and then critically, within the possession or control of the district attorney. And so we're debating on whether it's known or not known to the district attorney, but what remains unchanged by this bill is whether it's, at least my reading of it, is whether it's in currently in possession or control of the district attorney. And any member of our panel is welcome to, or any subsequent witness as well. Your thoughts, please?
Thank you, Chair Barker and Representative Hicks. I see that, and I read that also. In the 50 states that Ms. Meyer has highlighted for us, the if known to the prosecutor language in the actual line of their language seems to limit the scope of the information that needs to be sought and provided. I understand that's not a real satisfactory answer to you. We can talk
if you want later. I'm not trying to put you on the stump the chump here, but I'm not. That's why I'm not following a lot of what is coming up here, because I'm not seeing how we're expanding that at all.
If you do a comparison between the proposed language here and the 50 states, it is much broader.
Thank you.
Actually, it's a comment, not a question, so we can do it while transitioning panels, if you prefer.
I'll call up next Aaron Knott, Michael Slauson, and Scott Healy.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if this is as good a time as any to make some legislative history, and I would like to go on record echoing Professor Frohnmayer's comments and legislative history categorically. It's certainly not my intent, nor do I believe it's this legislature's intent to expand this area of law so much as codify existing law. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Department of Justice and the Attorney General. We are also here in opposition to Senate Bill 492. Our reason for appearing is somewhat different than the district attorneys who you've heard from so far. We initially assessed this bill just for its technical effect and ultimately moved to a position of opposition, and I'll explain why. First of all, when you engage in a codification of complicated case law, there will be appellate ramifications. That's the biggest part of why we're here. We handle that. And that's not a reason not to do it. We like appellate stuff. We think it's fun. But in this case, you are taking dozens, if not hundreds, of cases across the country that have tried to interpret this constitutional provision and boil that down to one statutory provision. That's going to require complex election of what language you use, what language you don't use. And if you look at the history of 492, we're in our eighth iteration here. And most of them were full-blooded, honest attempts at codification that were abandoned and then replaced with others. And the reason I highlight that is because from an appellate perspective, there's not going to be a right answer here. There's not going to be a one-to-one port you can make where you say this statute, the way it's articulated now, I think there was an attempt at this in A7 where it actually said just this won't exceed constitutional language, but in every other iteration, there's going to be real interpretive work that needs to be done. And I've seen the fiscal coming out of appellate for Department of Justice. I don't think you guys have it yet, so consider this tentative. I don't think it's been finalized, but we estimate that the cost to the Department of Justice of trying to advance the legislative interpretation that's being proposed here will be about $125,000 in the next biennium and the biennium that follows. So aggregated, that's about $250,000. That would be acceptable to the Department of Justice if we felt that 492 would do what it sets out to do. Our concern is that there's a misunderstanding of why the Brady and discovery violations are happening at all, and that what the hope ultimately is here is if you take something that's in case law and put it in statute, that will really change things. And we've heard a lot of stories on both sides about what discovery violations are happening, but we're not hearing a lot about why it is that an officer or a prosecutor is not following already existing law, because we're all in agreement that this law exists already. We're just trying to codify it. So a prosecutor is already not following the law, and a police officer is already not following the law. Why is that? Well, if the reason is rooted ultimately in the fact that prosecutors and officers don't take case law seriously, but they take statutes seriously, then you are indeed well positioned to fix the problem. However, if discovery violations are being caused by resource failures, training errors, overwork, or simple honest mistake, this will not make an inroad into that problem. The Department of Justice comments on this because we're responsible for a significant amount of the training. It's been testified to you that officers don't or can't understand constitutional law, but constitutional law governs almost everything they do. Miranda's an easy one. I think you guys all understand that. But every law enforcement officer is grilled and trained endlessly on search and seizure principles that are boundlessly complex, fill up huge books, and nobody is talking about codifying because it would be impossible. But we rely on officers to be able to make those decisions, not just in the culture of the courtroom, but in real time when they're out making arrests. And if they're wrong, their cases get tossed. They're trained on this all the time. They have that capacity. Similarly, prosecutors, they go to law school. They learn about case law. Like our appellate division, we think they like it. So we really, I think from the Department of Justice's perspective, the best argument that's been made today was the argument that was made by Chair Barker, that we need to be investing what we think will be $250,000 in training that will send the message down to these officers about what a Brady violation is and how it should be avoided, as opposed to spending that money on the hope that an officer out on the street or a prosecutor in the courtroom will, for some reason, look at a statutory provision differently than they do a constitutional one. I'll ask Michael Slauson, who is an assistant attorney general in our criminal justice division, is here to talk technically about the language to testify, and then we'll both be available for questions.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slauson, and I do work in the criminal justice division. I also work on the department's ethics committee, the legal ethics committee. I represent my division on that committee, and so in that capacity I deal with a lot of issues related to Brady. The purpose of my testimony is actually to respond to Representative Hicks' question, which is, what would courts do with this? And I want to get down in the weeds a little bit also to respond to Representative Tomei's questions about specifically what are the differences between Senate Bill 492 and Brady. I could highlight some of those differences. What the ultimate consequences of the differences might be will be left up to the courts, but I do want to let you guys know precisely what I think some differences are, and I've got three different differences than you've heard previously. So the first thing that this does, it removes the materiality requirement that is Brady. So under Brady, that the evidence that's failed to be disclosed has to be material. And that makes sense, so that if there is a Brady violation, we know what the remedy is that the person gets a new trial because it affected their trial and the person didn't get a fair trial. So that's responsive to Representative Garrett's question earlier on, is what would be the remedy for this violation when you find out after the trials happened and something wasn't disclosed, it should have been disclosed in the statute, but it wasn't material. What's the remedy there? And that's something that's unanswerable that will be left up open to the court. So that's the significant difference from Brady, because we just don't know what the revenue is going to be, what the cost associated with that litigation is going to be. The other thing it does, and Representative Tomei, I thought you maybe asked a question about what exculpate means. Well, I actually grabbed the dictionary definition out of the same dictionary that the Supreme Court uses. And I want to point to some language specifically in the bill that causes me some pause. And you look at the current line on page 1, line 25, and it talks about any material information that tends to exculpate the defendant. And exculpate, looking at the dictionary definition, means to clear from alleged fault or guilt, prove to be guiltless. So that's what exculpate means. But the next line is what I find a bit troublesome. It says negate or mitigate the defendant's guilt or punishment or impeach a witness. Now, as we know, that the court's obligation is to give effect to each word that the legislature chooses to include in a statute. So here you have what appears to be a redundancy. You have any material information that tends to exculpate the defendant, and then the next line is negate or mitigate the defendant's guilt. By the dictionary definition employed by the Oregon Supreme Court, that's a redundancy. So what the communication would be when the Oregon courts are required to uphold the legislature's intent is to add meaning to that word those words that's different than exculpate. And we don't know what that is. It's unclear. So that is a difference from Brady, and that could lead to ambiguity and additional litigation.
The other question that's come up quite a bit is that question about any material or information and what that means and why that might be different than Brady. I would just direct your attention to the exhibit by the OCDLA. It refers to evidence. And sometimes I've heard up here people discussing the term evidence synonymously with information or material, but it's not. Evidence is something different than information or material. Evidence generally, you would think of something that relates to this case specific. Information or material really could be anything. And I'll give you an example, and I will tell you that it is a sort of an outlandish example, but might fall under the scope of the statute. But the point being is not whether it does fall in with the scope of the statute, but that we don't know whether or not it would, and that's important. So I have in my office right now, I prosecute online child exploitation crimes, child pornography crimes. I have in my office right now an op-ed opinion piece, which I find very offensive. It's very apologetic for child pornography offenders and says that they should be treated very lightly, maybe get probation, and that what they do is not that bad. So I find that very offensive, but it's in my office. It is material or information that tends to negate or mitigate the defendant's punishment. Certainly, they have articulated arguments in that opinion that the defense could use in advance of its argument seeking a probationary sentence or some other lesser sentence other than prison. Now, I'm reading this on its face, and when I'm referring to material or information, which is much broader than evidence, I don't know if I'd have to disclose that. I don't know if my colleagues would have to disclose that. I don't know if I get an email from Mr. Healy from Clackamas County about a study on recidivism of sex offenders that says they're not likely to recidivate, if I have to disclose that. So it is, in fact, much broader, because each word that you change in isolation can make a difference. But when you look at all of these taken together, the breadth of the changes, we just don't know. They could be quite sweeping. So that is the problem with trying to codify the Brady rule by making even just subtle differences and not being very careful with the language, including redundancies. We don't know where we're going to end up ultimately.
Cool question. It could be for any of you, but to our knowledge, in the states that have codified Brady, have we seen a huge upswell of litigation or disciplinary actions against prosecutors for alleged violations? Is there some correlation between codifying this and opening up the door to what you're concerned about? Has that actually been, have we seen concrete results of that in these states?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, I'm not familiar if we've seen like appellate opinions a way to document in these particular jurisdictions who have codified variations of the Brady Bill. So I don't know how it's been employed. I do know that as the Oregon legislature operates, or excuse me, the Oregon courts operate in their rules under PGE and their interpretive rules is that they need to give meaning to each individual word in the statute, and they need to apply the dictionary definitions to discern the legislative intent. So my purpose is to say that under Oregon law, there are significant issues with the particular wording of this bill that could create a lot of litigation in our state.
Question of Mr. Sachin. That op-ed, was that written by a guy named Mr. Madison, perchance?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, I don't remember because it's a bit old. It's probably about 5 or 6 years
ago. It was a joke. I'm sorry.
And we're over time. I apologize. We're going to have to close the meeting. Members have other commitments they need to get to. We will roll this over to Monday. So I will roll the meeting over, and we are adjourned. Sorry.